More than a month after the jury returned a verdict of death for Boston Marathon bomber Zahar Tsarnaev, all the raw wounds were ripped open again with victim impact statements. And we were once again reminded of the pain and suffering caused by Tsarnaev and his brother Tamerlan. Today, Judge George O'Toole officially carried out the jury's verdict, a verdict he couldn't change, sentencing Zahar Tsarnaev to death by execution. But before the judge did that, we heard from Tsarnaev himself, asking Allah for forgiveness. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Kevin, the last time we talked, the last time I saw you was the middle of May, and I have to tell you, some ways today feels like Groundhog Day.
Yes, it did. It felt exactly like Groundhog Day.
And I don't mean to be flip with that, but we are right back in the thick of where we were last spring.
Yeah, in some respects, because of the cumulative effect, we heard from 24 different people who suffered grievously. And the one thing that came through, a number of the people got up there and talked about invisible wounds, talking about post-traumatic stress, talking about traumatic brain injury. And, you know, sometimes we focus properly on the, 17 people lost their limbs in this crime. Four people lost their lives. And yet there are dozens and dozens of people out there whose lives have been grievously impacted by wounds that you can't see. And so the only way we really knew about this is they got up there and they addressed the court.
Megan Zippin, who we hadn't heard from before, one of those people that hasn't, I don't know if she's appeared in the newspapers, hasn't got very little attention. She expressed her frustration with doing a victim impact statement today by saying, you know, it's like taking a dandelion that has gone to seed and with the wind at your back blowing it. And there are thousands of seeds that go downwind, and it's like trying to pull them all back. And I think whether she meant to suggest this as well, it's like the lives of these victims where we realize just how profound, how widespread the consequences are. Carol Downing talked about having to worry about two daughters, how she's been broken financially, how she hasn't been able to attend her own injuries, how every day she is spent taking care of, worrying about them, seeing multiple surgeries.
Yeah, the shrapnel that pierced the legs of Erica Brannick and Nicole Gross, her daughters, literally, that shrapnel did not pierce Carol Downing, at least physically. But when you listened to her, you saw the damage that bomb did to her. Her life has been turned upside down, and it's not over. The idea that this process we just went through and culminating today with the formal sentencing of Zahar Tsarnaev offers closure, this shows there's no closure for these people. They're going to live with this for years, if not for the rest of their lives.
What is stunning about this is the fact that what was said in this courtroom in the form of victim impact statements today could have no effect on the sentence itself.
No.
You know, the first reason, the original intent of victim impact statements was to provide the judge with a sense from the person who knew the harm best, namely the victim, before imposing a sentence. Instead, you see the other rationales that have been given for allowing people to deliver victim impact statements: healing, therapy, the ability to confront the person, to look him in the eyes, and even to vent anger. And we had lots of raw anger.
There was an awful lot of anger. I thought Sean Collier's sister, Jen, was absolutely racked. And you could see how she is struggling. Again, somebody who wasn't physically hit by the bomb, but who is just devastated by the impact of that bomb. I thought that Bill Richard provided sort of a balance to that. He made it clear that Zahar Tsarnaev had choices and that he clearly could have not taken part in that bombing. He, as Bill Richard said, you could have got help from your brother. You could have said, hey, my brother's up to this. You didn't do that. You chose hate. You chose to do what you do. Bill Richard pointed out that choices were forced on his family, and his family chose love, his family chose peace, and he said that's the difference between us and him.
That's one of those moments of grace that I appreciated today, because there weren't a lot of those moments.
There weren't a lot of them.
There's
a lot of anger. And the other person who got up there, we talk about how small of a town this is. There's a young man named J.P. Craven.
Wonderful.
J.P. is 27 years old. He's a teacher at St. Sebastian's. And when he was about 6 years old, I was one of the coaches on his little soccer team in Hingham. And, you know, I reminded him of that, and he says, geez, I don't think I played since I was 6 or 7. He went on to other sports. He was a terrific athlete. JP was pierced by a number of the BBs that were in the bombs. He was grievously injured. And he was the one that I think, even more so than Bill Richard, held out the prospect of redemption, that there was this idea that even Jahar Zainayev, with reflection, with showing remorse, could get to another place. And he was the only victim that really held that out as where we might be going, and it was prescient.
He said, and I was struck by it, because he said, Jahar possesses a unique ability to be a force for good and for changing lives. And you know, when you think about these victim impact statements and whatever people hope to get out of them, there is this strange existential connection between the defendant and the victim that doesn't exist between the victim and the prosecution. It's the defendant that can someday possibly bring some relief to the victim by trying to explain himself. I thought Craven was, it was very touching when he talked about that possibility.
Yeah.
Because otherwise today, I thought the four corners of that room were just draped with death.
Yeah. But you know, it's also interesting. I exchanged emails with JP's father, Joe, who says that JP has handled this better than he and his wife, that they're in awe of the way he has responded to this. And in his personal experience, what he did, JP said, okay, we're going to use this to make things better. And they've raised like $400,000 for Boston Medical Center. The city hospital takes care of the poor, and they took care of JP, and that's what he's done. And so you can see, when he walked into that courtroom today, JP Craven was already at a better place. And that's why he was the one, I think, that was able to rise above anger, which I think, I'm not criticizing any of the victims. I think I'd be more like everybody else. I don't think I'd be like JP Craven, but he was able to rise above that. And almost, like I said, it to me was almost like a challenge, the way he put it to Jahar Zainayev. That you can come out of this in a better place.
What victim impact statements always indicate is the range of people's ability to respond or their current status in somehow putting their lives back together. And clearly, without criticizing anyone, clearly some people are much farther along the road than others.
We're all different, and that came through loudly and clear with these victim statements today.
So all of a sudden, I hear before the break, Judy Clark say that, well, we're going to have an allocution. And immediately I jumped to think, all right, we're going to hear this voice. And we have not heard his voice. We saw a little clip of it on a video, but we've not really heard that voice.
And there was a glimpse of it, I remember, during his arraignment. If you remember back then, he spoke and it almost sounded Russian. And this accent sounded even different today. It sounded more, for lack of a better term, the way you would hear somebody who Arabic would be their native language if they were speaking English.
He starts off, I mean, he talks about Allah. This is the blessed month of Ramadan. I would like to now apologize to the victims and the survivors immediately after the bombing, which I am guilty of. I did it with my brother. I learned of some of the victims. I learned their names, their faces, their age. And throughout this trial, more of those victims were given names, faces. They had burdened souls.
He went on. He said, now I am sorry for the lives that I've taken, for the suffering that I've caused, for the damage I've done, irreparable damage. Now I am Muslim. My religion is Islam. The God I worship, besides whom there is no other God, is Allah. And I prayed for Allah to bestow his mercy upon the deceased, those affected in the bombing, and their families.
And by the way, he did have a moment where he talked about what strength, what patience, what dignity the victims had shown when they took the stand. And in all fairness, there are people that are angry. They're not going to accept what he says. We hear that in their impact statements before he ever speaks. On the other hand, the statement has a huge missing hole in it, doesn't it?
Well, he certainly didn't renounce the motive that drove him to this. He didn't raise anything about that. You know, I talked to a number of the victims after, and it was really a split decision, as they'd say. Karen Brassad, for example, said she didn't buy it at all. In fact, she said it sounded pretty good. And then at the end, he said, and Allah knows best those deserving of his mercy. Now, to Karen Brassad and a number of the other victims, that felt like he pulled the rug right under them, that he put out these words, and then when he said that Allah will choose, knows who's best, they took that implication being it wasn't them, it was him.
Remember, the statement we have, his explanation for why he did what he did is on the panel of the boat in which he was right. found. And that still is his most forthright statement. So you would think that an apology, saying sorry, if in fact he's sorry, he's remorseful, he needs to renounce what he wrote
right.
in the boat.
And Bill Weinrub, the prosecutor, made that exact point. He said there was, you know, this is an issue of, you know, there is no renunciation of actually using terrorism to kill innocent people. And that would have made the apology a little more powerful. I think if he did go that far, then I think you would have seen a lot more victims saying, okay, I accept that. But it seems to me very few in this early reading accept what he said.
So what we have here are the people making the victim impact statements today. Then there's this remarkable, highly unusual situation where you have practically all the jurors mm-hmm. who condemned him to death sitting in the jury box. And later the U.S. attorney comes in, she shares the stage with mm-hmm. some of the people who are making have made victim impact statements. It's almost as if there's a manufacturing of consent or the possibility someone would think this is all one team. It was for the death penalty. It was the mm-hmm. death penalty team. Justice has been served. Several of the people that made the victim impact statements told the jury, you did the right thing. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there is this split, as we all know, in which perhaps a majority of the victims were opposed seeking the death penalty, but the victim impact statements prevent them from saying what they want to have as a sentence.
Right. We get back to this point that the jury that sentenced Jahar Zainayev to death was not necessarily representative of this community. The death penalty was pretty well in place when that jury was impaneled. I mean, and with hindsight, I believe that even more so, David. The only way he was going to be spared the death penalty is if someone genuinely believes it was a worse punishment to have him sentenced to life.
And so George O'Toole imposed that which he couldn't change, that what he had in shape, the verdict. I thought it was interesting. He went to the classics, mm-hmm. both Verdi's opera, Otello, Credo in un Dio crudel is the line from the opera. I believe in a cruel God. And here is O'Toole. Surely someone who believes that God smiles on and rewards the deliberate killing and maiming of innocents believes in a cruel God. That is not. It cannot be the God of Islam. Anyone who is led to believe otherwise has been maliciously and willfully deceived.
It's a powerful moment. And I thought the other, you mentioned he also quoted from Shakespeare, say that one of Shakespeare's characters observes, the evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. He paused, and the judge added, so it will be for Jahar Zainayev.
So where are we at the end of the day, Kevin?
This is one of those days you kind of knew how it was going to end, even though certainly when I walked into court today, I did not expect to hear from Jahar Zainayev. And yet, what I walk away with, take out of this day, is just the number of lives that are absolutely devastated by this, and that it doesn't end for so many of these victims. In our business, we do it like this. We say that more than 200 people were injured. You listen to people today, and that's not even close to the number.
No.
It's not even close to the numbers when you go through these families. I felt that I knew this case and I knew the suffering involved. And then I come in today and I feel like I didn't know Jack. I didn't have an idea of how wide and deep this hurt is.
We ended with somebody who's speaking who was seen as a bright star, somebody that had come to America and had started a new life and was beloved by people who knew him. And when you look at that and you see what happened and you see the evil that took place, you realize just how significant and overpowering a problem and a challenge we have.
I was so struck by the judge's words on when he directed his comments right to Jahar Zainayev, because technically the victims weren't supposed to. The judge said to Jahar Zainayev, whenever your name is mentioned, what will be remembered is the evil you have done. No one will remember that your teachers were fond of you. No one will mention that your friends found you funny and fun to be with. No one will say you are a talented athlete or that you displayed compassion in being a best buddy or that you showed more respect to your women friends than your male peers did. What will be remembered is that you murdered and maimed innocent people, and that you did it willfully and intentionally. You did it on purpose. And that to accomplish it, you had to redefine yourself. You had to forget your own humanity, the common humanity that you shared with your brother Martin and your sister Lindsay. I thought that was powerful stuff.
There's Julius Caesar. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is off, interred with their bones. And so, Kevin, this brings us to the end of Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial, which is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston. I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Look for us again when this appeal moves forward, and there are going to be years of appeals. Thanks, pal.
Thanks, David.